Hey everyone, and welcome to Sped Homeschool Conversations. Thanks for joining us tonight. And we're starting a new month, a new topic. We're going to start talking about evaluations and record keeping. And so we're diving right into that, into the most meaty stuff probably of this whole month. And we're going to be talking about high school and documenting and disabilities and all of that. And our special guest tonight is Julene Walker. Welcome, Julene, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I just want to give you a quick blurb about me and my background. So I have a license in the state of Indiana from kindergarten through 12th grade for mild special interventions. So all of the kids that I've had on my caseloads in the past have been on the general diploma track or the 440 diploma track, working towards their high school diploma here in Indiana. I've taught for 5.5 years at a local high school, public high school called Warsaw Community High School. And so I worked a lot with freshmen through seniors and transitioning them into adulthood, whether it be college, trade school, or just jobs afterwards, and kids on the autism spectrum, ADHD, learning disabilities, and emotional disabilities. So I've kind of had a broad range of that. So, yeah. And then, I became pregnant with my first son and I decided to stay home and start a private tutoring business. So I've been doing that for 2 years now, and we welcomed another little boy. So I have a 2-year-old son and a 5-month-old son, which has been crazy. So the majority of my clients are homeschoolers, and I also started and run a 1-day-a-week homeschool academy. It's a 1-day-a-week thing here in our town. So I work a lot with our local homeschooling families in Indiana. So that's a little bit about me. Mm-hmm.
Great. Yeah, we connect because you're on our consultant page on the Sped Homeschool website, and so parents can connect with you if they want consulting or tutoring. And I asked you if we could talk about something, and this was your area of passion. And as we were talking ahead of the broadcast, you said, "Yeah, I know all this stuff about high school, but people that are coming to me would have younger kids." So even if you have a younger child, I want to encourage you to just stay with us. We're going to be talking about high school and documents and why you should have that. But would you agree with me that documenting when kids are even younger is important as well, and knowing this information?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Because even eventually, if you decide to pursue testing and things further on, a lot of times it eases the process if you have that documentation all along. It makes it drastically, drastically easier for you. Mm-hmm. So,
Yeah, I think that's the thing to point out is it may seem like it's really time consuming to do this, but the payoff in the end, you're going to say, oh my goodness, I'm so glad that I'm not looking. I talked to so many parents as a consultant for 2 different state organizations, and they would be scurrying around trying to pull together all this paperwork because they documented stuff, but not in a very organized fashion. And then when they had to have it, they were pulling, from things that were maybe okay or maybe accepted by who they had to give it to, but it was really difficult to walk them through that process. So I'm hoping that we'll definitely be talking about a lot of that. So if you're joining us, if you have questions, put them in the feed. We will be able to see them, we'll be able to read them and respond to them, and we'll pass them on to Julene to answer while we're live this hour. So that's the bonus of being with us live versus watching the recorded sessions or listening to our podcast. Mm-hmm. Thank all of you for joining us as well. So let's dive in to, I wanted to say the name of your tutoring is Fingerprint Tutoring. Mm-hmm. So we'll share that website with everyone so that they can connect with you as well. Let's start talking about what is a disability, first of all, because I think, a lot of our parents have struggling learners, but a disability is very different, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's one of the biggest things that I have found as I've been working with homeschooling families about figuring out what that actually means. So a disability is not something that just affects their learning. It involves something that's probably going to follow them through their lifetime. And that's really important to know, because that means that it's not just going to be when they're at home with you in those homeschooling years. And when I talk about disability, there's such a broad range with that. And so generally I'm going to be talking about the kids that are on the track to become independent later. If you have a child that's going to always need your dependence and your guardianship, that's another ball game, which I won't necessarily get into all the way in this one. But so generally when I talk about them going on, usually means they're going to be independent after school is over when they turn 18 or older. So, but yeah, it's something that's not going to affect them just in their schooling or their time at home, but it's going to be something that is going to affect them later on, whether it be finding a job, going to college, continuing their job, things like that. And so your homeschooling job isn't just preparing them educationally, but it's also preparing them and equip them with whatever they may pursue once they are finished homeschooling. So it's important to note that disability is a lifelong thing. And also it is a legal definition. And so therefore there has to be some documented legalities with it. And in the homeschooling realm, it's wonderful to have the freedom to do what we would like with our own children. But at a certain point, when it comes to disability, we're talking about the laws and rights that affect everyone in the nation. And so we have to make sure that we follow, there are certain things, not a lot, but there are certain things we have to make sure we follow. And one of those is getting official documentation to prove that they have a disability. And we'll talk about how that is and what that looks like and things like that. But it's important to know it's a legal issue.
Right. Yes. And if you're listening or watching from another country too, I want you to understand that, you know, the laws that we're going to talk about are a little different because we're going to be focusing on the United States laws, but definitely look into what is required as far as documentation for asking for services for testing or job accommodations and those types of things. College accommodations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. So let's dive. We want to dive into those laws then next and what they are, how they affect different age groups, and as well as what parents need to realize about the effectiveness of the law or the usefulness through each of those.
So the number one that parents will probably hear about, obviously, it depends on your state as well, but there is one overall arching federal law called the IDEA 2004 law. And if you knew anything of special ed before 2004, it has completely changed. So ignore anything you thought you knew about special ed prior to 2004. but this new federal law dictates several things. There's 13 major disability categories, and I'm not going to go into all of them, but in order for your child to qualify for services in the public school, they would need to qualify under one of those 13 categories. And this federal law is for kids that are enrolled in public school. Mm-hmm. Now, where it applies to homeschooling is if you are in a state where the homeschool is considered a private school, and HSLDEA has, I don't remember how to, all the pronunciations for, is it HSLDEA?
Yes,
they have a website that dictates the specific states that are considered private. But there is actually federal money that is given to the state that can only be used for private schools. And so sometimes you're able to access that private funding depending on, and that's a whole nother step that we won't go into necessarily here, but it's just important to note that IDEA is a lot of times when people talk about special ed services, that's for children 3 through 18 for general ed. If you have a child with some more severe disability, it goes older. Now, each state has their own law that can either be, it has to have at least those IDEA laws, but they might be a little more specific. In Indiana, it's called Article 7. I'm not sure in Texas or other states what they're called, but you can look and see. So your teachers and people may reference those state laws as well. But the IDEA trumps that. And then there is the ADA law, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act. And when we talk about College Board and colleges and universities, they look to this ADA law. The IDEA law is not for colleges and universities necessarily. That's more for public schools. So go ahead, sorry.
I put up the address for HSLDA.
Oh, perfect.
If you want to look by the state stats, that is the website that Julian mm-hmm. shared with me. So you can definitely yeah. check out that. Or if you're yeah. Listening and you can't see, if you're on our podcast, mm-hmm. Just go to HSLDA and look for state homeschooling mm-hmm. laws and struggle.
And, yeah. The IDEA 2004 law is an educational law, so it's under the Department of Education. The Article 7 or the state law is also under that Department of Education. But if you ever hear of the term Section 504, which is also an education law, it's actually a civil law and it's under the Civil Rights Department. So they're in different areas. And usually 504 is determined by a doctor and IDEA is usually determined by the school system. Not always, but a lot of times. And ADA law is also a civil law through the Department of Justice. So the departments of where these laws are coming from are different. So the regulations of them are different as well. So it's important to note that when we're talking about these laws, the stage of your child is under different laws. So if you're looking for services through your local school while you're homeschooling, it's going to be a little different than if you're looking for SAT accommodations or college accommodations. It's a little different depending on what you're looking at.
Right. Yes, because it's all hinging on those different laws, and that's why they're required mm-hmm. to do those. But yeah, they also have different purposes behind those laws, and it's good to understand why mm-hmm. those laws were created, because then you'll understand why they provide certain services and they don't provide others. I think parents get really frustrated when they say, well, the school should just offer me these services because this is where my child's lacking. And I remember having a conversation with one parent, and she said, well, my son has got physical therapy up to this point, and now that he's reached this level, they said he's done. And I said, well, you have to understand the school's version of what physical therapy needs are is to meet the educational demands within the school, not mm-hmm. his civil, you mm-hmm. know,
yeah.
how he relates to the world around mm-hmm. him, it's how he relates in school. That's mm-hmm. that was the extent of what the IDEA covers. And so mm-hmm. if you look at it from that perspective, you'll get much less frustrated when you go to the school and say, but my child needs this to function. Because we as parents at homeschool, we look at the whole child. Where the school mm-hmm. looks at the learning part of our child, and that's the part that they're working on. So, mm-hmm. so yes, and that's why.
Yeah. Well, and then I noticed a lot of times too, especially with ADHD and ADD and disabilities that come from a doctor's diagnosis, they may qualify a child for a disability under IDEA, but not always. Just because your child has ADHD doesn't mean they qualify for services through IDEA. And so sometimes when you get a doctor diagnosis compared to a school's diagnosis, it's different and or it's not as severe enough to affect the child's learning for services. So it just depends. So it can kind of get tricky when you go between the two, 504 and ADEA and things like that.
Yes,
so.
Exactly. Yeah. And so so as far as what you would recommend to parents for getting testing, is there, mm-hmm. Do you go by like diagnosis type or what you're seeing or by age or what would gauge, where would I go to get yeah. testing for my child?
Yeah. Okay, so we'll kind of start with the age part. If you have a child that's young, we'll start there because it's a little easier. If you have a child that's young and really struggling, if they truly have a disability, those learning gaps are going to continue to grow as they get older and older if there's truly disability. Because if you think about it, special education is an individualized education, and I don't think you get much more individualized than homeschooling. So if you are doing lots of different ways of helping your child and they're still not getting it, that might be a sign that there's a disability there and maybe you would want to pursue it at that point. And I've had some parents that are wary of getting testing because they're afraid of the state or the government coming after them for homeschooling their child. That is, they don't have time to worry about that. It's truly something that could be for your benefit. Number one, it helps them. It shows you specifically where their learning gaps are, so you know what to target without trying to just be experimenting with things. It really tells you and hones in on here's where they're really struggling. And then it also really helps to plan and kind of figure out where you're going to go from there instead of just floundering, like, well, this one didn't work and that one didn't work. It really helps with your planning and brings a lot less frustration there. So a lot of parents who say, well, I just want to wait. Sometimes that's okay to wait to see how things go and you kind of get to know a little bit more, but sometimes it helps you along in the process. Now, when they get to the high school level, if you truly think your child has a disability or they're really struggling still, I would highly suggest you get them tested, and here's why. So if they are still struggling with a certain area in high school, that usually means it is a disability at that point.
Yeah.
And if you're pursuing testing, it could mean that they need help on SATs. It means they may need help in their college classes. It may need help when they are in their job. And I have an example. I have a friend, and she was diagnosed with a learning disability, reading disability, and she had extra time and reading aloud accommodations on her SAT. She had extra time and reading on her tests in college. And then when she got her job in business marketing, she was able to get a program that the company paid for to read all of the work on her computer that she needed to have read to her. And she went on to get her MBA, and while she was doing that, she needed help on the GMAT test for accommodations as a 28-year-old, so she got accommodations. So I helped her get accommodations for the test, and in her MBA classes, her master-level classes through an elite high school or college, she is getting accommodations as well, extra time on her test. So even when you go into all of these upper-level educational things, if they truly have a disability, it's going to keep affecting them in those ways, in various areas, and you don't know what they're going to be. Maybe it's not going to be that much and they don't need as many services, but at least you prepared them in case they did. So,
and I suppose your friend, with all of, you know, the previous documentation mm-hmm. for each step, made it probably easier mm-hmm. for the accommodations the next time.
Yes. So, and a lot of times too, so College Board and most colleges usually require about, usually the safe bet is 3 years current testing of their last diagnosis of when they were last tested. Some are up to 5 years, but I would say a 3 year is a safe bet. And then a lot of times, so once you're accepted into a college with those 3 years, that will usually, because the college accepted you, if you go on your MBA later, that usually, well, your college accepted it back then. So that even though it's not 3 years at that point, your MBA will probably accept it because the college did. So sometimes they tag along with each other that way.
I heard in the past that, you know, once you hit a certain age, they consider a disability mm-hmm. permanent on your record so that mm-hmm. you don't have to be retested as an adult. Mm-hmm. They figure, well, as an adult, you've kind of...
mm-hmm.
You're not growing anymore, so you should mm-hmm. probably have that disability for a lifelong.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And usually the disabilities that are more like visual impairment or hearing impairment are more of like physical and more IQ in nature. A lot of times those tend to be more not really questioned. Obviously, if you have a visual impairment, you have a visual impairment. It's usually the ambiguous ones like reading disability or writing or math. Sometimes those can be a little bit more ambiguous than the other ones, so.
Let's talk a little bit about documentation and getting services. And does mm-hmm. that guarantee that my child is going to get services just because I've mm-hmm. documented or tested a certain mm-hmm. disability?
Yeah. So in preparing for when I was consulting with various families and preparing various things for this presentation as well, I was looking at, I called a couple colleges. Every college has a learning disability or a learning area or special services area where they legally have to provide services for people with disabilities, hence the ADA law, which is why it's important to have an official documented disability if you have one. And so I called them to see what exactly they require. Most of the time when they get accommodation requests and things like that, they're from public schools or private schools. They don't necessarily always get homeschooling things, so I was kind of careful to, and now every college can sometimes the law isn't necessarily specific on everything homeschool related for, and so it may depend on the state. So certain colleges in various states may be slightly different. But most of the time, the ADA is a federal law. And so they make sure that the testing that you get to prove that they have a disability has to be through a legal licensed qualified individual. And I sent a link through the ADA law. We'll post it on later too.
Oh yes, I've got those. portals or the testing accommodations, the ADA government.
Yeah. The document requests, and then both of them you can put up.
Okay.
So both of these list, yeah. Both of these list what exams are covered under this law. So if your child wants to go to the ACT, the SAT, or the ASVAB, or other types of things like that. They also list what are normal available accommodations. And a lot of times they're just extra time or having it read out loud to them or being in a smaller group environment. Things like that. Or if your child has a visual impairment, they provide braille things or things in large print, things like that. And then they show what documentation is needed. And if I were to go over all of that, we would be here all night and into the next week. There's so many little things along it that you would just, that you will just kind of want to read through yourself. But basically when it comes to colleges and things like that, they're looking to see, if you have that official documentation, but then just because they have that legal documentation doesn't mean that it affects them enough that they need services for these tests, which is why it becomes very important for you as a homeschooling parent to have documentation that is not just, oh, today we did this and they did this. It needs to be more official so they understand that this is, it needs to be more official.
You have the history of using whatever accommodations or modifications mm-hmm. on a regular basis that it was a necessity mm-hmm. and it was used in your homeschool
So if you're requesting extra time and you go back and they're like, well, do they ever need this? Well, you know, they kind of, well, if they never used it before, why do they need it now on this official test? You can't just pick and choose when they want to use it. You need to, even in the public schools, they have to prove on our documents. When I would have case conferences every year with my kids, I would tell them, you know what? You didn't ever come out to get your tests read to you, so you can't request them in college because I don't have documentation that proved that you even used them in high school. So if you want these in college, you're going to have to start using them. And if you're not using them, you may not need them. So so that's kind of the mentality, too. You want to make sure that if your child is taking an hour to take a short quiz and that's what they need, then document that. Show them. And we'll talk about what that looks like to document it. But those are the times that you really want to document. So what I would do is really go through that list to see what are those available accommodations that are common and see, oh, this might benefit my child. And then kind of make a note of maybe these are some of the ones that we will really pursue. And most of the time, it's always extra time or tests being read out loud. Those are the two main ones that usually people pursue.
Different sections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's interesting as you go through that list, you might be accommodating your child and not even realizing that you're doing it. And then you look at mm-hmm. the list and go, oh, well, we do that.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
To just look at to say, mm-hmm. you know, what are we doing maybe to be accommodating that we haven't mm-hmm. been documenting? So you can use mm-hmm. the flip side as well. And exactly. I do have that other link up there for you. Mm-hmm. But, I have a question. Are you okay with switching over to that for just a little while? Vanessa asked, if a job candidate discloses ADHD dyslexia on a job application, are they less likely to get the job? Are most employers willing to accommodate?
So they're not. That gets tricky because that goes into the ADA law, which protects adults with Americans with disabilities, it used to be adults with disabilities, it's Americans with disabilities. So what's tricky about that is with ADHD and things like that, if they are applying for a job that no, they cannot discriminate against you from what I've understood from the law.
Right. Yeah.
And and the reason for accommodating, a lot of times, I'm trying to think of how to answer this. I don't know when they really usually ask you that on an application question. And usually when you disclose it, if there's any realization that they are using that, then that's a very big legal issue. So most of the time they won't even ask you that at the beginning. But once, can you put the question back up? I know it was ADHD and dyslexia.
Right.
Sorry.
Are they less likely to get the job, and are most employers willing to accommodate?
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's really questions.
Yeah, it's they have to be willing to accommodate, and so and most of the time, accommodations doesn't mean if they're not performing their job correctly or well, that doesn't necessarily protect them. Now, if they were struggling to do their job because, like, for instance, my friend who has a reading disability, she was doing market research for them, and she would spend hours and hours and hours a day reading and poring over all of this information. And it was really hard for her to just sit there for hours, and it was just draining. And so it was accommodating for them to get this program for her because it made her job easier. She still was able to perform her job, but it was very difficult to do. And so that's usually kind of where it goes. Now, if you have a visual impairment, I don't think you should apply to be a neurosurgeon. You know what I mean? I feel like there's, I'm trying to use like a big gap there. Not that you shouldn't be able to apply for things that might be difficult for you, but ADHD and dyslexia, most of the time, no, they are very willing to accommodate, and they will rarely ever, yeah, they're not allowed to discriminate against you. And I don't think usually people consider that very much because they're not looking at, they're not looking at that. They're looking at your other qualifications and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. And now there's so much research on the advantages mm-hmm. of hiring people with specifically
yes.
those two,
yes.
mm-hmm. those two diagnoses because of the way they think. And so the,
yeah.
the attitude has been changing in their culture
mm-hmm.
about hiring people who have what we, you know, consider learning disabilities, but really
mm-hmm.
Show us that they think differently, and
mm-hmm.
that comes to their advantage as well. I know
mm-hmm.
I have a son that made me do these broadcasts who has dyslexia and ADHD, and he was the the creative
mm-hmm.
force behind this. And so,
mm-hmm.
so yes, I always tell him it's his fault and that he's so creative.
Yeah.
But yes, you know, I think employers are. And like you said, legally, they have to accommodate.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's those are things that affect not usually the main part of your job.
Mm-hmm.
They're just the things that you need to
mm-hmm.
to keep within the sphere of being able to function on a regular basis. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
And they're never legally allowed to ask you if you have one or not. Like, especially in college applications, or like college professors, are they have it in their syllabuses every time. Legally, they are not allowed to ask you if you have a learning disability. If you have or any disability, if you have a disability, you have to go to each professor and tell them one-on-one or individually. Even if you tell the school that you have a disability and have it on file, they don't tell any professors. You have to go to each professor individually and tell them. So there's a lot of legalities with that too. So I don't think that there'll be an issue.
And also my oldest is on the autism spectrum. He chose not to be diagnosed and not get accommodations in college. I left that up to him, and
mm-hmm.
He's had struggles in college, and there's been a process where he felt he was not being treated equally. And so he took it up to the dean of the college and said, this is the work I handed in. This was the grade I got. I don't think I was treated fairly. And he actually got his grade changed because the professor had been biased just towards his inability sometimes to articulate himself. But he didn't bring up his disability at all. He just said, you know what, here's the work I did. This is the grade I got. And
mm-hmm.
so there's things like that in colleges too that
mm-hmm.
that have checks and balances for kids that feel like, you know, I don't feel like
mm-hmm.
I'm getting
yeah.
evenly scored as my classmates.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Another example, kind of on the flip side, my friend that has a disability, or a learning disability, she said when she went to apply for the MBA program, and it was an elite online program, and she met the requirement for the GMAT test. That was one of the requirements, was a certain grade or a certain number, and she got that, but one of the subtests on it was too low, and so they told her they weren't going to accept her due to this low score on this one subtest, which happened to be in the reading area. So she made an appeal to the learning center, and she sent the required documentation in, and I wrote up a long blurb of, you know, throwing out legal terms, but and she submitted that, and they sent it back. You know what? This makes total sense. It's not a problem. And what they did was they said, we just want you to maintain this certain GPA, and we'd love to have you in the program. And she was admitted in, even though one of the subtests wasn't the correct thing. She still met the general requirement. It was just the one. So sometimes it helps with that too, having that legality there. So.
Right. Yes, exactly. So how do we then document what we need to document from what we are teaching and homeschooling? And I mean, mm-hmm. there's a lot of things that we can document that I think parents don't realize are important to mm-hmm. have written down. So let's kind of go through that a little bit.
Yeah. So you have to remember too, when documentation takes place, when a learning disability takes place, I've had a lot of parents that have told me, oh, my child has a writing disability, or they have a reading disability. And then I will meet with them for an initial thing, and I will think, wow, they definitely do, or oh my goodness, they're not going to qualify. And a lot of times it's because some parents have been doing it for many, many kids, and then this one child is really struggling in this area, and they're comparing them to their other children, and maybe their other children were phenomenal writers and this one is not. So I've had that before, where some of them get tested through the local school and they didn't qualify. So a lot of times when they're officially tested, they're being compared to the norm of the whatever the stats are from that. So it's not just my kid struggles with it. They're compared to other peers their age in that area of struggle. So that's important to note. So as you're kind of gathering documentation for things, what I would really start is where your child is currently at. Look at their weaknesses. Have work samples. Document instances or episodes. So if they have ADHD, document. Even though it's not necessarily official, but if it's like ADHD, have like an ADHD journal documentation where you show today they couldn't sit for more than 2 minutes, and they failed this test because they couldn't focus, or blah, 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 and document it how often it happens. So it's pretty powerful when you lay down a journal that has every instance of your child struggling with something, and they understand, okay, this is a daily thing. And it may seem like a lot of work, but if you're doing it little bit by little bit, it really isn't as much as you think.
Cheap school planners, and every day mm-hmm. just make a note, this is what happened today. And mm-hmm. by the end of the year, you've got 100 plus days of documentation right there.
Another thing is gathering work samples for kids with learning disabilities, a lot of times with writing or with reading disabilities. And maybe they took a test and they just totally bombed it. Maybe on that test you can write, they took it on this day and they struggled, they completed it in this amount of time, and kind of put that on there so they can see, okay, wow, they did this amount of work and it took them 2 hours and that's all they got on it. And so sometimes, or they can see, wow, they are really poor at forming their letters, or their spelling is atrocious. There's another sign here of something. So any of those work samples that you feel like really demonstrate their weaknesses, those are really important to make note of. And it seems like, we'll go on about their strengths too, but it seems like, oh, I'm just bringing my child down by, you don't have to necessarily show them all of what you're keeping track of either, because that is very derogatory for your child, but it's not necessarily focusing on there, it's just starting with their weaknesses so you can see where you need to fill the gaps in.
And as you keep those year by year too, you're going to see the progress in all of those areas, but it's nice. On the mom side of that, it's nice to see yes, we did make some progress, even though in my mind this year. So yes.
Yeah. So on the flip side, it is good to maximize on their strengths as well. So for instance, I had, I knew of one of my kids from another school. They really struggled in the areas of writing, but they didn't necessarily have a reading disability. So they were reading fine, but their spelling was terrible. And so sometimes various disabilities show up in other areas. And so getting them legally tested can help show, those areas. But having those areas of strength help figure out where the areas of weakness are as well, and how, once you do know their areas of weakness, how to help them compensate with their strengths, especially when it comes to like their learning style. So if they have a reading disability, but they're really much an auditory learner, then give them an audio book or a book on tape or whatever to listen. Because if you want them to gain the literature knowledge, who cares if they actually read it word for word? They, even if they're hearing it, they're still gaining that literature knowledge. Now, if you're
interviewed an audiobook author who said he'd been looking at studies, and he said you actually learn equally the same through an audiobook as through reading, which I thought was incredible, you know, data. So we may force our kids to read, but is it really, are we letting them cheat by making them listen? Not really. It's the same process that's happening in their brain.
Yeah. Now, if you're giving them a test to see what their reading comprehension is like, that's different. You don't want them to be listening to the reading comprehension things on. So it depends on what you're really trying them to figure out. If you're giving them a spelling test, you don't want them to use spell check. If you're giving them a computation test on their math facts, then they should know how to do their math computation. But if you're doing a really hard algebraic problem, let them use a calculator, because you're not testing them on whether they can do 5 + 5 or 2 × 10 or whatever. So it kind of plays into that, maximize where their strengths are. So, and then in addition to those two big things, you really want to look at then from there, what are your areas of concern? So is your area of concern them being able to get through algebra when they get to high school? They struggle with math, so are they going to pass algebra? It's not necessarily are they going to get a job. You know they're going to get a job. It may be in plumbing, or it may be in business, and it has nothing to do with math or whatever, or you're not worried about them after. It's just, okay, but in order to do that, they have to pass algebra, and they really struggle with math. So what are your specific areas of concern? And their areas as well. Ask them, what are they concerned about? And kind of getting those will help pinpoint, okay, so those kind of turn into goals, which we'll talk about a little later too, of, okay, so here's our concerns and here's how we're going to move forward to address those concerns. So, but having them written out and being very visible to you and your child at the same time will really help.
And I love that, because high school, definitely you can start having this conversation. You know, we're focusing on that group that is going to transition out of your home. And so having that conversation with them, this is their life that you are orchestrating or helping them orchestrate. At some point, they will take ownership of this, and it's better that you prepare them in the direction that they want to go versus your direction.
Yeah.
It makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, I was telling Peggy as well before we started, but I came from a school district that I really learned a lot from my previous boss, and she was training us all when I was leaving on how to, I never ended up doing it by the time I left, but they were training students how to lead their own IEP meetings and going over their own disabilities and their own strengths and weaknesses. So a lot of times giving them that ownership will really help with them advocating for themselves and pursuing and figuring out what do I need and how do I get that. So then when they are on their own, they can do that on their own too. And you just kind of help jumpstart that process.
They fully understand those struggles. I mean, but can articulate them as well. Not just, I've got an issue with this, and you need to understand that. It's you know, I can give you what I need, you know, in a nice concrete package to help you understand it as well as helping. So, Absolutely. So I guess we were going to talk a little bit, that we already covered with the benefits. Accommodations and adjusting curriculum, that's definitely an area too that we need to focus on, not only as we prepare them for testing, but also, you know, even pointing those things out to our student as we're doing them. And I know it helped my children, you know, to realize, see that we're doing this again, because sometimes you can tell them, you know, you need this accommodation, like, oh, no, I don't. I'm really fine without it. Until, you know, you start pointing out all the times that they're saying, oh, can you do this for me? Or can you help me with this? And I'm like, do you realize that this is what we're doing? That's important for them to understand the frequency and also, you know, documenting that.
And some other things you could do too is if say they have a weekly quiz they have to do for you, maybe 1 month they do the quiz without any accommodations, and then the next month they do them with all the accommodations that are available to them, and then compare the 2 months to see how did they do on them, what was your stress level like, how was it different there, and that might be a good way to document too, and then keep that documentation as well, and maybe have like an interview form where you ask your child, okay, which was easier for you. And sometimes a lot of my kids, especially with like reading on tests, they only needed some help. They just needed someone to read a random question to them. They didn't need every single one, but it was nice to have that available when they needed it. So maybe your child only needs it a little bit, or maybe they just get so much testing anxiety that it's just the extra time that they need. So it might help pinpoint too, you know what, they really don't need their test read. They just need that extra time. Or maybe they need extra breaks in their tests because they can focus a lot more if they only have to do 3 problems at one time, and then they can have a break and then do another 5 problems and then have a break, which is a combination you can have on some of those. You can have extra additional breaks. So kind of playing around with, you have that freedom as well. Now as a senior, you haven't lost the horse or anything, like if you're a senior, there's maybe not as much time, but you can definitely go back and look over things as well, and then maybe have some interviews with your child to kind of go back, okay, let's think about the last couple of years, and let's think about the subjects and what subjects did you do well in, and let's look and see, okay, why did I do well in this subject? What were the type of assignments we did? Were they all project-based? Were they papers? Were they presentations? Were they reading passages? Were they oral presentations? What exactly about them were easier or harder, and then kind of go from there as well. So that's another area as well.
That's a really good point. I never even thought of, you know, mixing it up and then evaluating at the end of each, you know, variation of the test to say, what made this easier? What made this harder? That's some really great advice.
Yeah,
definitely.
And the other thing that I tell parents as well is, when they struggle with one specific skill, so let's, like for instance, I had a conversation with a mom the other day, and her child had really poor handwriting, and she said that it was just very burdensome for him to try handwriting on all these assignments, and they just weren't getting anywhere, and he was getting frustrated. And so I told her, I said, then what you need to do is take one writing assignment and one question and say, okay, on this question, we are going to work on your handwriting. And so then you pinpoint their skills, and then you hone in on, okay, well, let's adjust it here and let's adjust it there. And then the rest of the writing assignment, you're not necessarily focusing on that. You're focusing on other things. And then maybe the next writing assignment, you want to focus on punctuation. And if those are the areas they're really struggling in, then you can really practice those skills individually without them getting overwhelmed. And then as they slowly start to build those skills, you can continue to add them more and more to the assignments. Now, if they're a senior in high school, they need to capitalize every sentence. But if they're in first grade and they're not doing it every time, maybe slow it down and focus on one skill at a time. So that way they're not having meltdowns every time because they keep failing over and over again. They can put all their energy into that one practice.
Going on. Yes, exactly. Yeah, I can see the benefit of that because, you know, we often just want the perfect result of all of these things we're teaching our child, but especially for kids who have ADHD, you know, and trying to just focus on one thing, if we can give them that one thing that you just need to work on, and the rest, we'll worry about the rest later and bring it all together.
Definitely. Or even for, say they have a reading disability, if you're doing a history curriculum and it's heavy in reading and they're failing history, it's probably not because they don't know their history. It's probably because they're really struggling with reading. So maybe find a different way to teach the reading so that they're not burdensome with the reading area. And they're really showing you, I know my history because of this. Or so like kind of pinpoint what are their struggle areas and then see if that's what's affecting their grade in all the areas. Because if they're failing every class because they struggle with reading, that's demoralizing. And so if you can step away from the reading areas and kind of help them focus on the subject itself, not on the skill, then that right. helps a lot too with figuring
well,
out.
I think that my oldest read extremely well after 12. He didn't read before that, but, but so he had a very literature heavy based curriculum, and I could not use that for my second child because he had dyslexia and he had auditory processing on top of it issues. So it made content very difficult. So I had to totally switch curriculums so that what we were working on had very, had audiobooks, but also short sections of content that was audio because he couldn't even listen to the long contents because of his auditory processing issues. And so those are the types of things as you, you know, you look at that and changing out curriculum based on what you see in document, you just have to do in the high school years.
Yeah. And another thing too is when they are, like when they notice like the specific, a lot of people are like, oh, well, they're going to be prepared for college if they can, you know, alter their curriculum every time. Well, what you're teaching them is how, what their strengths are and how to maximize on it. So when they go to college and the professor says, here, read these 100 pages, they're still going to be prepared with what helps them to do that. And so it's not necessarily.
If they're introduced to the technology ahead of time and know how to use it, then they're going to think, oh, 100 pages. Well, I can put it into this program or I can use this reader. And sure, I can do that.
So it does still help them to, even if you change it up a little bit. As long as you don't, now if they need to know how to do algebraic problems, and they're all two steps or something, and you only make them do one step, and they never learn how to do two steps. Now, you need to make sure they are meeting the goals that are set in for the various curriculums in that sense. And so we could get into technical terms of accommodations versus modifications, but you just want to make sure. But anyway, all that to say, it will help them still prepare for college and things like that.
Yeah. So let's dive in. We've got about, 12 minutes left, but how to document an IEP for a student.
Yeah.
And, it was funny that Julene shared a couple links with me. I'm like, oh, I wrote those. Unfortunately, they had been attributed to someone else. So, the nice thing is we have made the links that you gave interactive on our website now. And so I thought I would bring up that page. Just what that looks like. And it's I'll share the link too, because it's not extremely easy to find because we've kind of buried it under our getting started page. There's an option on there. It says more paperwork. and then there's, how to write your own IEP step-by-step. And I also want parents to know if the whole IEP thing is like totally scary to you, if you are a member of HSLDA, they'll do it for you. That's part of their member benefits. So definitely take advantage of that.
And once an IEP is written, it is a lot easier to just adjust it every year than it is to start it from scratch. So it's not like
this is the link on our website, and I'm going to see if I can share my, let's see, I mean, I don't disappear from you here, but this is not, nope, it's not going to.
Well, while you're doing that too, we were talking about earlier too, there's several ways to obtain official documentation. If for some reason you did go through your local public school, if you're in a state where it's considered private school, you can request testing through the school and they will write an IEP for you, and then you would just say, well, actually, I still want to homeschool, but you can still keep that documentation. So they would be writing an IEP for you as well. So that's one option as well, if you are in that area or if you have schools that you trust to do that. And so that's one option that you are able to do, is go through the school as well. And you're not, you can, that's your documentation to have. So that's part of the IDEA federal law. It's called Child Find. It's part of the law that.
Yes.
So, yep. Which is another legal term. But.
And I am unable to share my desktop screen. My husband must have updated Chrome and erased my share screen option because I used to be able to do it a couple weeks ago. So on this page, what we have on there is a lot of links for articles that our team has written, like things to prepare before you even write your IEP. We have a couple members on our team that are ex-special ed teachers, and they've written lots of IEPs, so they put together different articles. And so those articles are intermixed between like different things on how to determine a baseline, diagnostic testing, kind of a lot of things we've been talking about. It has a link to the College Board accommodation guidelines, questions to ask a diagnostician when your child's getting diagnosed and you're wanting to know, what do these test results really mean? And then there's links to goal banks on there and how to write goals, how to make them measurable, and then even goal tracking forms and how to use prompting, data collection type of things. That page is just full of a lot of information. So,
and another thing too that I would suggest is I am one that when I was in college learning to write diagnostic tests for when I would test children with disability or for learning disabilities, I would look. We were given sample reports and I was glued to those and I knew this was a really good report. So I would base mine on that really good report. So even finding a really well-written IEP and seeing how can you translate that to show my child's IEP, even I know there, you could even just Google like through your state, you could find a sample IEP through your state. And because a lot of times colleges and school college board look at those those IEPs. So a lot of times you can base it on those and then it becomes a lot easier too because you have a really good sample to follow as opposed to just, I don't know if this sounds good or not, but.
Right, exactly.
That helps a lot.
That's where those goal banks come in handy. Those goals are the ones that public school teachers use as well. And so you're using the same type of goals and they're already written for you. And also I want people to know if they live in Texas, there's an IEP generation tool that the Texas Homeschool Coalition created.
Yes.
Actually, it's my that. So if you're a member of THSC, you actually just enter in all your data and it spits out your IEP. It's an awesome program. So I don't know if we were talking when I worked for them about making that a nationally accessible, but they're still working on that. I think they did copyright it though. So
that's awesome.
Having those goals, let's just tell parents why it's so helpful. I know a lot of them have asked me because I give a whole talk on how to write an IEP and how to use it effectively in your homeschool. I get the question, but is it really that helpful to have an IEP and especially the goal part? What would you say to a parent who asked you that question?
Well, I feel like in the area of homeschooling and disability and all of those things, it is a huge broad spectrum. And how do you know? It just helps bring it in where you can see whether progress is being made. You can be very intentional about what you are using with your child. And you can be very specific about whether or not they're reaching that And that actually alleviates a lot of stress in your life because you can hone in on very specific things for your individual child. Because the whole point of an IEP is an individualized education plan. Well, what is your plan? The goal is the goals are the meat of your plan. And okay, what do we want them to be able to do? Well, we want them to be able to do this and this and this. Okay, well, how are we going to be able to get them to do that? So you need to really hone in on that
ahead of time instead of just saying, well, the curriculum's going to show me how to get them from this point to this point. That doesn't happen with kids who struggle because they're probably using 2, 3, 4 different curriculums all at the same time and trying to mix them in to reach that goal. Definitely. I love what you said. It's the meat of the IEP. Yeah. You know, yes, we document all those other things, the baseline, the, you know, their behavior interventions, the accommodations, and how we are going to modify, but those goals are what focus on. So I generally tell parents to get, you know, to focus on 3. Is that about what you would say too?
Yeah, I sometimes would get IEPs from middle school teachers and they'd be like 5 or 6 goals. I'm like, how do you monitor all of these? And then the poor kids, like, how are they going to remember all of them? You want your kid to remember them too. And if you keep even 2 to 3, that 3 is a good number of, okay, then that way you can remind them of their goals and that they're in on it too and not just something you're just, okay, I don't know if they're reaching that. Make them a part of it, and that will really help too.
That they're not learning in all these other areas either. Mm-hmm. This is just where you're really pressing in and focusing on the instruction. And that's a good thing. We have another question, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It says, when a student is diagnosed with ADHD and dyslexia in elementary school, can you use that diagnosis through the entire school career, or do you need testing again when older?
It is a very good question. So ADHD and dyslexia, well, dyslexia is its own ball game because ADHD, under the IDEA law, it would be considered an other health impairment. That's what it would be under like a school law. And so a lot of times high school or like SAT College Board and like universities will kind of look at it that way. But ADHD is a medical diagnosis, and so you have to have that medical diagnosis. I don't know, because it's medically diagnosed, how many years, but usually your child usually is probably getting a yearly checkup anyway. And so unless for some reason the doctor's like, oh, you don't get distracted anymore, you must not. So usually it's okay as long as it's a medical diagnosis. Now, if they were in kindergarten and you're trying to apply using kindergarten testing, I would say generally it's good to have updated testing once they reach high school. Maybe sophomore year would be an ideal year.
The school by age 13, because that's age 14 is when they do the transition plans planning at school. Mm-hmm. So they want to base the transition plan off of new tests. So that's a good baseline to go on to.
And then, so I know like a lot of, like when we would apply for SAT accommodations for some of my kids, if they were sophomores wanting to take the SAT as a junior, and I knew that their last testing was in 7th or 8th grade, I would have them apply immediately as soon as they entered high school to get approved for those accommodations, because I knew that 3-year mark would be coming up. And so they would still be able to qualify for accommodations. So sometimes you can maximize them when you apply for them based on. So that's another thing too.
How long does that application last then? If you apply for these accommodations?
I don't know how long it lasts. I think once you're approved, it stays on their system for a while. I think, I know my friend, she took the SAT in high school. And then it was probably 6 or 7 years between when she graduated from college and when she took her GMAT test, and they qualified there. So a lot of times when you get up to the upper level, like
the college board.
It's kind of like once you're in, it might be a good grandfather in kind of thing. So
Well, that's always good to ask too.
Yeah, it's very good to check and make sure, because it might depend on the college as well. So
Right. Yes. And that's a good thing to point out as we're finishing up too. Definitely approach the college you think that your student is going to go to, because they do have individual nuances in their policies. So it's good to understand, instead of saying this is the general overall covering of what colleges offer and accept, what do you specifically want out of me and my child, so that we can get these accommodations that we're looking at as being appropriate. Yeah.
And if you go on a college visit, you can request that part of that visit be a meeting with the Learning Center or whatever special services organization they have. You can meet with someone from there, and they'll make sure to include that in your college tour when you're there, if you want to do it while you're there, or just do it on the phone later on, but you can pick that. So.
All right. Well, thanks, Jolene.
No problem.
This discussion, again, it goes by so fast. And
I know. I'm like,
oh, I'm your questions. And so this was great, because I don't think we talk about this enough, because we're so focused on teaching our kids and in the now and just kind of pushing them through, but we push them through without giving them what they need to keep going. And so it's good to point out these things that we need to be working on little by little. And like you said, if we do it little by little, it won't seem over consuming. And that's, I think, what's important. So.
Thank you for letting me come and talk. So I appreciate it.
You can find Jolene. We've got I'll post your website, but it's
Tutoring and Services.
We'll definitely leave that in the feed and get people pointed to you there if you want to talk to Jolene more. But we're going to continue on with this testing theme. So next week, we're going to be talking about using the MAP test results to individualize instruction for your students. So we're just going to introduce to you what the MAP test is and then how you can use those results to teach your student where they struggle, you know, to compensate for those struggles, but also to use their giftedness in areas. And so that'll be next week. So thanks all for joining us, and thank you again, Jolene. And so we'll see you all again next week, and thank you for joining us on Sped Homeschool Conversations. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.